see everybody, and again, just express my gratitude and with the diversity amongst us that we keep showing up together for what can be sometimes uncomfortable conversations. And several of you have said to me that these are challenging and difficult at times. Some of you have also said, didn't get that story today at all. That's perfectly okay too. What we're doing, sorry, I should say, my name is Glenn, and I'm from Northern Ireland, and this week we're looking at a series of, for what for many of us in the room would be massively familiar stories that we heard as children in Sunday school. What do we, and where we're handed a particular interpretation or meaning of those stories, what is the place of those familiar children's stories now that we're be kind to one another, we are slightly more mature and a little bit older? Do these old stories have, can these old stories become as complicated and complex as life has become as we've grown up? And also, particularly in the complexity of the world we find ourselves in today, can we find ancient wisdom in these stories that we first received as children? And part of it requires a willingness on our part to accept that there is complexity in the story, to resist the temptation. And those of you who are preachers perhaps know particularly well the temptation to offer people the meaning of the story. But also the temptation for those of us who aren't preachers to receive a meaning as the meaning and then leave it there. So the story is flattened out and the story has one meaning received as children, and then we can leave it behind. But to recognize that as we bring all our lived experience to these stories, we can find different doors in, different ways in. We can recognize ourselves in different ways and in different places and in different characters in the same story. That's the brilliance of good stories. And so it requires of us, the funny thing is, I think often in certainly my experience has been within Christian faith and church circles, we're actually really bad readers. And we can read, we're literate, but we're poor readers of story. But stories are immensely, good stories are immensely flexible and pliable and move with us, so long as we resist this temptation to flatten them out into the meaning or the moral or the point. And that's particularly the case with the parables, and tomorrow we're going to look at perhaps the most well-known. We began with the Good Samaritan, we'd finish with the prodigal. So stories are terrifically important. Learning to become readers and interpreters of stories and tellers of stories, really important. I've spent almost 30 years in Northern Ireland working in conflict and dealing with conflict and peace and reconciliation work. And we, in the organization I work for, we use stories a lot as a kind of, almost like a third party that we can introduce into a conflict. Where parties to that conflict can almost play out the conflict with each other through the story. And the story absorbs the conflict and absorbs the worst excesses of the conflict, which then allows us to talk about the difficult things between us. And the story is the beginning place. So, and a lot of these familiar stories are ways in which we can do that. Because one of the things that happens as we learn to read stories, as we learn to tell stories, and particularly, I'm getting a lot of stick from a lot of people about indulging myself and showing you pictures of my family and my dogs and things. But actually, there's a purpose to that. Because as I tell you stories about me, it opens up my experience to you. It allows you to get to know me a little better. You can understand why, in some cases, I'm looking at the story in this particular way. It opens us up to one another when we tell one another stories, personal stories, and it draws generosity from one another as we hear one another's stories, and particularly in the politics back home and in the politics here, when conversations between the wings and from the wings are really difficult. We need to find ways of approaching one another with generosity and kindness. And one of the ways we can do that is through our stories, our personal stories. So I make no apologies for showing you pictures of my dogs and my children and family life. And today we're looking at the story of Ruth and Boaz. And this is the only photograph I'm going to show you today. And it's deliberately chosen for this story, and you're probably thinking, but Ruth and Boaz is a lovely love story. I used the words of Ruth and Boaz at my wedding. Why is he putting that up? This is a picture, this is a photograph that I took in June of this year. I've got many like it. But this is a photograph of what we call in Belfast the peace lines. See those chimney pots on the far side of the fencing? Those are Catholic homes. And we're standing, and the photograph is taken from the Protestant side of the wall. And that wall, I wanted to show you people to give you an idea of scale, but it meant that I couldn't fit the whole of the wall in. It goes up several layers beyond. Probably it would go to the top of the screen because they've had to. So this concrete part was the original size of the wall. Then as people got more sophisticated in how they could attack the other side, they put this second, then they put that up, and then they put a further wall on top of that to stop communities, to draw a line between a community, a line that shouldn't be crossed, to separate communities.
So who built the wall, Seth?
Sorry?
Who built the wall?
It's a government-funded project. The government, because both communities are in conflict, where the two communities rub up against each other, they become points of conflict because we can't cope with the difference between us. So the easiest way to sort out the difference is to build a wall. And now some of you have been to Belfast and have seen those walls. Yeah, Chuck's here. We visit many of those walls in Belfast. Yes, we were talking about them. You know the bizarre thing? Peace agreement was signed back in the mid-90s, 1998. More of these have been built since the peace agreement than were ever built during the conflict. The peace agreement dealt with the worst of our violent actions towards one another, the peace agreement did not deal with the issue of reconciliation. And that is still a problem we have to deal with. And so we build these walls to keep one another apart. Yeah. And behind those walls, all sorts of different impressions and stereotypes of each community can grow and are sustained across those differences. And the walls only serve as now as points where conflict happens. They haven't made communities safe. Yes, John.
Did I hear you call it the peace line?
We call them peace lines.
It's commonly referred to.
That's what they're called, peace lines. But they are actually, these are the magnets for conflict. So currently, this past summer, just at the beginning of July, in one Chuck will know well, in East Belfast, there was particular tension at the edges of the peace lines where they won out. It's around here that the rioting starts and is sustained and so on. Peace lines, if anything could be named worse than.
So how do you figure out where to live since you're not on one side or the other? How do people that are neutral know where to live?
Well, no matter how I might choose to identify, other people will do work of identification for me. And so people place me where I should be. And this is where we want to get to today, because that's a really important question and a really important issue. So long as people stay in the boxes we assign them to, everything's fine. That's what we think. Problems start happening when people start to step out of those boxes. When people know their place, and we tell them what their place is, that's okay. But as soon as you get a little bit uppity and you start to imagine that you deserve a little bit more, then we've got to find a way of putting you back in your box. And the story of Ruth and Boaz actually works this out in a really, really interesting way, because the story of Ruth and Boaz is about defying those stereotypes, about what happens when people step out of the boxes that we have assigned them to. And what are the choices that communities face when we're overflowing our assigned places? So the story of Ruth and Boaz, it's a really interesting question why it's called the book is called Ruth, but the story of Ruth is essentially about two communities, two nations in this case, that live side by side, and both of them have stories about the other that are rooted in some degree of history, but are also exaggerated through time. Excuse me while I maneuver this. Do you know, you think I was here plenty of time to get ready, and then get distracted in conversation. So you have two nations that are living side by side. They have a long history of living side by side and a long history of division between them, so that the stories that sustain their identity are usually stories of opposition against the other. We talk about the narcissism of minor difference in Northern Ireland. The race issue here, the lines are very clear. The lines can be very clear in terms, just basically skin color. Whereas in Northern Ireland, we all look the same. And we talk about the narcissism of minor difference, that the smaller a real difference between any two people, in order to sustain a conflict, the larger those tiny things must loom in people's imagination. So we focus in on small, minor differences and blow them up out of all proportion and apply those small differences to a whole community. So at the beginning of the story of Ruth and Boaz, you have two countries, Israel and Moab, with a long history of enmity between them. And we're living in this story, in the story here in Israel. We know a little bit of it, of the antagonism between them. When these guys were wandering out of slavery through the wilderness, going through a particularly hungry time, they went to the king of Moab to provide food and water for the people, and the king of Moab said no. He was told by his advisors, you give those people anything, and literally the text says, they will hoover up everything.
Sounds like the story of the potato famine in Ireland.
Oh, don't. But actually, we will have to actually talk about that for a moment. So way back in the history of this people is a history of hunger and a request to a neighboring country for assistance in that hunger and a refusal. And so the opening line of the book of Ruth is, in the time of the judges, there was a famine in the town of Bethlehem. And a man called Elimelech and his wife and their two sons fled Israel, fled Bethlehem, and made their way to Moab. Hang on a minute. We've a history with those people. Never, ever, ever go to Moab when you're hungry. But this is what they do. Then the next line of the story is the two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, married two Moabite women. Hold on a minute. We also have a story about Moabite women. Moses is away meeting with God. He comes back. This is in our sacred text. Moses comes back. He hears the sound of tumult in the camp. He walks in and there's this orgy happening. And these poor, innocent men of Israel have been led astray by these loose, sexually voracious Moabite women. And you let your sons marry Moabite women? So this is like the first two or three verses of the book. The two stereotypes that the two mythologies that these people have about these people are addressed in the very beginning. There's famine and they go there for food, and they let their sons marry women from there. Like the most idiotic thing you could possibly do. And then there's death. Elimelech dies. And then the two sons die. And Naomi is left with her two sisters-in-law. All of that, five verses. Like, the writer gets all of this stuff out of the way in the first five verses. And then the rest of the book is about dismantling the lines that we draw between each other. The writer begins to dismantle the stereotypes to present these people with something they had never encountered before, which is a member of these people getting out of the box they've been assigned to. And what are we going to do, presented with the challenge of our traditional enemy getting out of the box we've assigned them? We also have a long story. There are lots of border crossings from Bethlehem to Moab and then back again. Naomi from Bethlehem becomes a foreigner in Moab, and contrary to all expectations, she's welcomed in. She finds a home for over 10 years there. Her sons find loyal, faithful, loving, committed partners. Again, against all the stereotypes. But in the face of all the death and all the loss and all the trauma of the preceding years, Naomi then decides to go back home and crosses a border back again. And Ruth agrees to go with her. So Ruth becomes a stranger now in Naomi's homeland. And they've got to navigate their way, find a way of surviving in their vulnerability. So lots of border crossings, not just physical borders, but also these borders up here, the borders that we have built in our hearts and in our heads against other people. So, I want you to think for a moment of an occasion when you crossed a line. Maybe it was a line, maybe you could tell a story about a line you should have crossed but didn't. Or a line you crossed happily and heartily, or one you put off crossing, or one you've never crossed is still there. If you want to talk, if your partner is sitting beside you, your neighbor is willing to talk, maybe you might take a moment or two to talk about the practice. What did it feel like either to come to a line and refuse to cross it, or when you cross the line? Don't feel the need, just signal to the neighbor if you don't want to, that you'd want to sit privately with this. But if you want to talk, please do. Let's take a minute or two to think about crossing lines. Again, as I've said frequently, act as if you understand what I've asked you to do. not call you back together again tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, I'll get back.
Challenges you faced, anybody, just give me snapshots. Don't need to hear the whole story, but just snapshots of the challenges of crossing lines.
Fear,
which, yeah, I mean, the wall I showed you, and this one, there are some people. Belfast is a very rigidly segregated city, and for the first time ever, earlier this year, I think. The transportation company introduced the first transport system that crossed the west of the city, across the middle, and into the east. The west of the city is predominantly Catholic, nationalist, and Republican. The east of the city is predominantly Protestant, Unionist, and Loyalist. And all bus systems travel through those communities and stop in the city centre, and then you get on another bus to go to the west. But for the first time, just earlier this year, they introduced one that travels right through. And a friend was telling me he met a bunch of women who had got on one of these buses in the west of the city, because they'd heard that this place called Ballyhackamore in the east, Chuck again will know it, is one of the up-and-coming places in the city. They'd never been there. Lots of restaurants and cafes. So they thought, we're going to go. They'd never been in the east before. You can walk from the west to the east in 30 minutes. And they'd never been across. And partly that was largely to do with fear of what they might encounter. Would they be recognized or as a stranger? Yeah. Other impressions of crossing lines?
The need, the perceived need to interpret to the other side of the line where what all those other people are thinking, where I'm most comfortable.
Yeah. The feeling I need to explain myself, I need to be understood, just in case, and I'm not a threat. You need to know I'm not a threat if I come here. It's an interesting one. Any other?
Assumptions about the other side. You live in ignorance, you don't really know, you've never been there, so you make assumptions that come with us.
Yeah, we make, because of the lack of encounter, we make assumptions. And partly why, again, working with stories, and particularly with personal stories, is it's very difficult to sustain the stereotype when you are faced with a human encounter. And yet, when our communities are rigidly segregated, you need to make a real effort to find encounter. And actually, and certainly if I'm in the position of privilege, the quest for encounter comes often with a significant cost on the part of the other person. I'm gonna, I'm gonna fly on into the text, because I think we've got a bit to do. This is the, and as we've done previous days, we're just gonna read the story, and I'll stop in various places to make some comment. And likewise, if there's things you're noticing in the story, we're not doing interpretation of the story. We're simply reading this and trying to find roots in, and then building bridges from that story to our contemporary situation. This is chapter 3. This is the emotional heart of the story, and it's also the scandalous part of the story, if you know it at all, but we'll get there. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, "My daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be well provided for." The phrase, "my daughter," is a significant change in what has gone up to this point. Naomi has come to Bethlehem as an outsider, as a stranger. Everywhere she goes, she is referred to as Ruth the Moabite. Every time, she cannot escape, she's one of them. In fact, in one situation, somebody describes her, "Oh, that's Ruth the Moabite from Moab." Just in case you didn't get the question. But here we have a significant change because of Naomi and the consistent loyalty and care and kindness of Ruth. Naomi finds it in her to use relational language. And this marks quite a big change. However, it's not the answer. It's part of it, but not the full. "I must find a home for you where you'll be well provided for." Now, Boaz, he's the central male character in the story, "with whose women you have worked as a relative of ours. Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you're there until he's finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do." "I will do whatever you say," Ruth answered. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. The storyteller wants us to notice something about the threshing floor. Three times in 5 verses. And some of you will have studied this story for sermon series and so on. But if you're not familiar with the story, or not particularly familiar with the story, what impression are you left? What is Naomi asking Ruth to do in verse 3? What does that suggest to you? Particularly if you're not familiar with the story.
Seduction.
Yeah, we did a really interesting discussion. I did a 5 days last week on this story. And we had a really interesting discussion about seduction. And whether this is a seduction story, or whether this is, as one woman in the group called it last week, survival prostitution. This is the way a vulnerable woman finds, this is what some vulnerable women have to do in order simply to survive. And this woman alerted me to the fact that the word seduction suggests some kind of reciprocal arrangement here. There's not a whole lot that's reciprocal. Naomi is asking Ruth to take an enormous risk here with her body. The threshing floor, you see, is where they threshed the grain. This is the end of the harvest. And at the end of the harvest, culturally, still to this day in parts of the Middle East, there's a, and I'm sure in other parts of the world, there's a party for the men at the threshing floor when all the work is done. And you'll see later on, you know, there's eating and drinking. You'll see later on, Boaz has plenty of both. And but it was also known, but never spoken about, that vulnerable women, particularly foreign widows, came down to the threshing floor after the party was well started, and they had to sell their bodies to get the resources to survive the winter. So there's an enormous threat to Ruth in what she's doing here. So she does everything her mother-in-law tells her to do. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, that's a euphemism, he went over to lie down at the end of far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet and lay down. That's the second time now we've talked this idea of uncovering his feet. And in the middle of the night, something startled the man, the drunken man, in the middle of the night, wakes up, turns, and there's a woman lying there beside him. It's a euphemism for uncovering his penis. And the suggestion is, whether it happens or not, the suggestion is this is an exchange. This is a sexual exchange. "Who are you?" he asked. I am your servant, Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family." I love the way, what was Naomi's instruction to Ruth?
Do
exactly. He will tell you what to do. And here's this guy in a drunken, bit of a drunken haze. And she takes command of the situation straight away. What we haven't read, but you can go back into chapter 2. There's a lovely situation in which Ruth is astounded that Boaz, a powerful, wealthy man, would notice her in her poverty. Who am I that you would notice me, a foreigner? And it's an extraordinary thing when we take that home and we think about our own lives and we think about our own culture and our own conflict here. The desire of people, the importance to people that simply they are noticed. And Boaz prays for her. He says, May the Lord shelter you under his wing. And he prays this lovely prayer for Ruth. But then she gets her own back right here, because she puts this exact language back to him again. "Remember you prayed for me? That the Lord would spread his garment, the corner of his garment over me? You have the resources to address my need. Don't push it away to God. You answer it. Answer your own prayer." And how it reminds me how sometimes our prayer for the needs of our world can actually function as a way of avoiding addressing those things. We talked last week, because of the week that was in it, we thought last week about how often in the face of crisis in our communities, we send people thoughts and prayers, but don't act. And here Ruth is challenging Boaz to say, it is not enough to send me thoughts and prayers. You take responsibility. Within the power and the resources you have, use those to deal, to sort my situation. You have a responsibility. "The Lord bless you, my daughter." Now we have the man with the power responding with relational language. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier." Kindness is the central word in the book of Ruth. But it's not a kind of a twee kind of, we're all really nice to one another and holding. Because we know, if we don't, we're going away at the end of the week. But we choose to be kind and generous to one another. But mere kindness, niceness, is not enough. The kindness expressed in the book of Ruth is the kind of kindness that transforms societies and communities. We'll see how that happens in just a minute. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You've not run after younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character. And although it is true that I'm a guardian redeemer of our family, there is another one more closely related than I. This is a part of the social protections built into the Mosaic Law. Weird in our ears, but if a man and a woman marry, and if they have no children, and if the man dies and they have no children, his father is required to marry the next oldest son to the woman so that a child can be born who will inherit the land of the brother who died. And if there's no other male sibling in the family, her father-in-law has that responsibility. So that the name of the deceased would not pass out of memory, and that their land wouldn't pass out of the family. So there is a closer relative than Boaz. So Boaz then says, you know, I'll sort this in the morning, but in the meantime, you wouldn't mind staying the night? Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to do his duty as your guardian redeemer, good, let him redeem you. But if he is not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it, but lie here until the morning. So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized. And he said, no one must know that a woman came to the threshing floor. Everybody knew women came to the threshing floor, but it wasn't talked about. And often some terrible things happen regularly in our society, in our towns and cities and in our communities that we all know about, but we just don't talk about. Lots of things exist below our professed noticing. Bring me the shawl you're wearing and hold it out. And when he did so, he poured into it 6 measures of barley and placed the bundle on her, and she went back to town. The interesting thing in this is she challenges Boaz to be the answer to his own prayer. Boaz has chosen now to treat this foreigner as family, as kin. That's an enormous step for this woman. It's a wrapping her into the family. But it is not enough. Because, and Boaz recognized it, and he said, we've got to do this properly, not just for you, Ruth, but for every woman in a similar situation. And so we have, in the final chapter, which we read quickly, the public policy change that's required in that community. Boaz went up to the town gate, which was the place where all the big decisions for the community are made. This is the Supreme Court of the town. And sat down just there as the guardian redeemer he had mentioned came along. Boaz said, come over here, my friend, and sit down. It's interesting, he's not given a name. This other guy's not given a name. He has a name in Jewish tradition, but not in the story. And you'll see why. Boaz says, come over here, my friend, sit down. Listen, you know he's been set up. Come over here, my friend, sit down. And he came over and sat down. Boaz took 10 of the elders. Now you definitely know he's been set up. I want some people to hear the conversation. Took 10 of the elders of the town and said, sit here. And they did so. So Boaz is a man of some considerable influence. So he's got 10 people sitting here, and he's sitting with this man. So they're all witnessing the conversation. He said to the guardian redeemer, Naomi, who's come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. That's Naomi's dead husband. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of those seated here and in the presence of the elders of the people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you're not, tell me so I will know, for no one has the right to redeem it except you, and I'm the next in line. The guy does a quick calculation in his head. Everybody in the town knows that Naomi is too old to have children. So he does a quick economic calculation. If I marry her, there's no possibility of any children. So when she dies, I inherit that land. It adds to my estate. I'm wealthier. My children. And it's a very earthy relationship with God, that the land you stand on is evidence of your blessing from God. So if you can increase the land you've got, you increase your sense of connection with God. So he's done the calculation. He says, certainly, I'll redeem it. And then the trap closes. Boaz said, oh, by the way, on the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. And at this, the guardian redeemer says, oh, that I can't. Because he does another quick mental calculation, and that is, she is young enough to have children. But the children I would have with her, because I consider her to be a foreigner, the children I have with her would not be one of us. And they will inherit the land. And what if I don't have children with my other wife? There is just the possibility that all of my land would pass into the hands of a foreigner who I don't consider part of the family. So all the land will pass out of the family. All the land will pass out of Israel into the hands of a foreigner. So I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to redeem the land. So the guardian redeemer in verse 8 said to Boaz, you buy it yourself. And it's legalized with this ritual of the passing of a sandal. Now Boaz puts this whole thing to the people. He announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon, they're the two sons. I've also acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. I am marrying Ruth, and I am treating her as if she is one of us for the purposes of inheritance. Like, this is breaking the law. And if the people say, hold on a minute, Ruth has a box, and all her people have a box, and they need to stay in that box because they're going to mess up this society. If people start spilling over the edges and crossing those lines, there's no end to the confusion this is going to cause in the country. Stay in the box. And Boaz is saying, I consider her kin. And I am marrying her for the sake of inheritance, so that the name will not disappear out of history. And I want you to witness this, and I want you to witness it as that kind of a transaction. I haven't got the text up, but all the people say, of course. Of course. And the boxes are broken. And the lines that existed between these peoples are erased, not just for the sake of Ruth, but also for all those other vulnerable widows, foreign widows, in that part of the world. This is a radical transformation of the law. So two things begin to wrap up this part of it. Two things to point out. Ruth would have been safe and secure if Boaz had simply responded to her need himself. He could have just married her and given up on the idea of any kind of inheritance and taken. And that would have been an extraordinary thing to do. That I've described it as a kind of private pietism. He is moved by her plight, and he chooses to address it. He does what he can to address it. However, there are lots of these other people out there. There's the question of relationship with the rest of the people, and he recognizes that a private response to this public need is not sufficient. That it must also be matched by a change in public policy. And so he gathers all the witnesses around. I told the story last week of running a series of these conversations. This work on Ruth emerged out of a situation back home in which both the British and Irish governments made a comment to us separately that in the midst of the Brexit divisions, they'd had submissions from all sorts of public bodies in both countries, industry, education, all sorts about the implications of Brexit, but the churches weren't talking about it at all, or not saying anything to the government. So we went and we spoke to clergy in church leaders, and they all said, we can't have this conversation, it's too difficult. Our congregations are divided on Brexit, and it's too difficult. We'd rather keep a surface peace and let those divisions exist. We don't want to raise them. So we took on to produce resources to enable congregations and interchurch groups to have difficult conversations about across borders, about identities and sense, and what differing senses of belonging. And it's been a fascinating project. And I kind of had a hunch that some of the same issues that are emerging in Brexit are things you're facing here, and certainly the conversations last week bore that out. But one series of these, four of them in fact, took place in a food bank in the town of Ballycastle in Northern Ireland. Are you familiar with food banks? Mm-hmm. People gather food and distribute to people in food poverty. They've become a kind of trendy social engagement back home. There's been I think the figures are something like a 5,000% rise in access to food banks in the last 10 years, which is unbelievable and scandalous in a nation as wealthy as the United Kingdom. 5,000% in 10 years. And churches are at the very forefront of that movement of establishing food banks in their communities, even cooperating across different traditions to make these things happen. The challenge is that as an act of public, of private pietism, it's absolutely necessary, and I don't want in any way to pour cold water, absolutely necessary. The problem is, if that's all we do, nobody's addressing what is causing the food poverty in the first place, which is the economic policies of government. And so this food bank is networked to a whole to hundreds and hundreds of food banks throughout the country, and they feed statistics every week of the food they've distributed, the number of people, the number of children, etc., etc., up to a coordinating body who puts all these figures together, who takes these figures and goes to government and said, are you not ashamed of yourself that this is happening under your watch? And so the private pietism is matched by this understanding, this is important, but it's not enough. We also need to engage at a public policy level. This is what Boaz does here. He responds privately, he meets her need, but then he says, we also need to do something in front of the Supreme Court. And makes it public so that what he does for Ruth is done for every woman in a similar position. And it's in the end of the chapter, it's really clear how the women rejoice at the end of chapter 4 because of the changes that have happened. It is not enough, you know, so you get this move. Chapter 2, Boaz prays for Ruth. Chapter 3, she says, answer your prayer yourself. You have the resources. And chapter 4 is the moving from that private pietism to public policy change. And I'm going to say one more thing, and then we'll have time to talk about this. I've worked with this story now in our own context back home for about 18 months or 2 years. 18 months, I think. I'm now convinced that it is the most radical book in the Bible. And I recognize that there is diversity in this room on the issue of politics and our political positions. And I'm so glad that we are finding a way of being in this room and staying in this room and returning to this room each morning, because that's really important. As we allow our sacred text to begin to mess with some of our established ideas on all sides. One of the reason I think this is the most radical book in the Bible, because it's the clearest example of the Bible, well, I think one of the clearest examples of the Bible itself reinterpreting the tradition in the face of new circumstances. You see, the law of Moses says, Moses said this, well, actually, God said this. If an Egyptian comes to you and wants to be part of the people, notwithstanding all they did to you in the past, you can let them become one of you after so many generations. If an Edomite comes to you, notwithstanding all they've done to you, they come and present, you can let them become one of you after so many generations. But because of what they did to you when you were in the desert and they didn't provide food for you, never, ever, ever forgive a Moabite. They should never become one of you. Draw the lines firmly and permanently between you and them. God said this. Moses wrote it down for them in the law. And that's what they lived with, this permanent line of division between them and us. The thing is, one way of looking at this is to say that in that early tradition that was handed to them from Moses, they had never even conceived of the possibility of a good, generous, hospitable, loyal Moabite. They'd never encountered one in their life. And so the law made sense. But time changes. What Boaz is doing in chapter 4 of this book is saying, times have changed. We never envisaged this in the past, but now it's come to our doorstep. Now the boxes we put people in have been broken, and times have changed. And Boaz is saying, I want to treat this woman as kin. And I want the other social security laws of Moses to apply to her as if she was one of us, without her having to convert or become one of us. And faced with this new experience, this new time, all the people say, of course. Chapter 4 of the book of Ruth is nothing less than the rewriting of the law of Moses. And it's in our Bible. It's in our Bible. There's no other way of, I can't see any other way of understanding this other than the tradition that has been handed down from generation to generation is radically altered in the face of a new circumstance. And all the people say yes. I'm not going to take, you know where that applies. We can think of so many circumstances in which that applies, where the book of Ruth can give us, and there's other examples in the Bible too, but Ruth is the clearest for me, where we have permission to mess with the tradition we've received in the face of new circumstances. You know what, back home? We are currently wrestling with the issue of LGBT inclusion in our churches. And the lines are being drawn very, very firmly. And we're arguing over what we call the clobber verses. Do you know what? It's possible, and I will concede this, it is possible to give a very coherent argument from the text of Scripture that says, don't ordain gay people, don't allow same-sex marriage, etc., etc., etc. You can do that. I'm not completely convinced, but you can do that. But there are other traditions in the Bible which say you can change these traditions in the light of new circumstances, new information, new insight, new worlds. The tradition, like the story, should not be locked down forever. These are told to us in stories in order to open up. And the way this works very quickly is they reckon this book of Ruth, was written after the exile, after the destruction of the Babylonian Empire destroyed the country, carted people off into exile. Those who were in exile in Babylon retained all these stories about God coming back again and restoring the greatness of the nation. And then Babylon was overrun by another empire who had a different way of settling people in conquered territories and allowed people to return back to Jerusalem. So they came back from Babylon. Over here, they came, well, down here. They came back from Babylon, back to Israel. And where's my black pen? There it is. They came back from Babylon, carrying with them these great visions of both an analysis of where we went wrong in the first place, why the country was destroyed in the first place, and also plans for restoration. But then there were other people coming back from another part of the world, and they came back with their analysis of what went wrong and their answers to how to restore it. And then there were people who never left the land, who had their own analysis. And all of these traditions and more are preserved within our Bible. You've got all these traditions, and we had a bit of fun last week imagining public policy conversations in Jerusalem after exile, and the slogan is, "Make Israel Great Again." And they had... So the followers of Ezekiel came back, and you can read it in the book of Ezekiel and some of the other prophets in the Hebrew Bible. And their analysis of the problem is this: worship. We didn't worship God in the right way, so restore right worship again. So all you people who've come back and you've started building your homes, you've started building the infrastructure of the country, what do you think you're doing? Stop all of that and rebuild the temple. Get worship again. Restore right worship again. And that's the route to make Israel great again. Then you had others like... Well, the practitioners of this are people like Ezra and Nehemiah. And Ezra and Nehemiah came back and they said... One of the analyses Nehemiah offers in the final chapter for what went wrong was foreigners. We allowed our men to marry foreign women. And they passed a law in Jerusalem to force divorce on men who had married foreign women and to send those women away. Because the problem, the reason why we were destroyed in the first place was because the boxes were broken. And to make Israel great again, we need to restore ethnic purity. You don't have to go too far in this country to think about that. The way to make us great is to restore the pure bloodline again. And so you've got all these political factions which are preserved. Isaiah has another one. Jeremiah's analysis is tear the whole thing down. The best thing that ever happened to us was the destruction of the temple. Don't go anywhere near that again. Don't go anywhere near capital cities and kings and empires. Tear it all down. And into this political ferment and argument doesn't come another politician. Comes a person who tells a story. The story of Ruth. And it becomes one of... It is fed into the culture right in the middle of all this political turmoil and says, let's talk about lines, let's talk about borders that need crossed, let's talk about the tradition we've inherited and how we change it. And the book of Ruth steps into the political ferment and challenges them all. And one of the things it does is, we didn't read it, but at the very end of it says, all of you who are thinking about ethnic purity as the way to resolve your problems here, I want you to remember that even our greatest king, David, had foreign blood. Because the son that is born to Ruth and Boaz becomes one of the ancestors of King David. Remember, the route forward is not through ethnic purity or the restoration of pure blood and pure race. Because we're mixed, is what they say. I hadn't meant to... I'm too carried away. But I appreciate some of you may have to leave, and I'm happy. But if there are comments or questions or reaction to this rereading of the story of Ruth. I'm not meaning to pour cold water on the romantic dimension of the story. That is a reading. But I think we are also aware of how complex the world is, and we can complexify that story just a little bit. It's not meant to undermine any other way we've approached the story, but it is to say, here's another route in, given our contemporary circumstances. Closing comments, reactions?
Quick comment?
So, yes.
Alloys are stronger than base metals.
I am not a scientist. I'm a. So
you take iron, it's strong. You have little carbon, it becomes steel and becomes much stronger.
Yeah.
So the alloy is stronger than the base metal.
Thank you.
If you were given responsibility to care for an acre of hybrid wheat for a summer.
Speak it out.
If you were given responsibility to be responsible for an acre of hybrid wheat for the summer or a forest, which would you choose and why? I had a biology professor asked us this. And of course the answer is the forest, because you'd have very little to do. The forest manages itself. If you only want to have one thing grow in an area, you're going to spend every day out there making sure that nothing
pulling out the weeds. Any other reactions? I mean, and pushback. I'm not expecting that everybody's comfortable with this, and really open to conversation. So happy to have pushback against this. That voice. This is how we, you know, craft our understanding of these stories and our walk of faith in the world. It's by this kind of interaction and debate, and committing not to fracturing relationships and walking away from one another. The brilliance of stories with different layers to them is that we can actually hold different understandings of these things at the same time. We look very much at that tomorrow.
I
found myself thinking about the Supreme Court, especially in light of the gun violence and the interpretation of the Second Amendment. And it's clear in our Supreme Court that there are two ways that they deal with the law. One side,
speak it up so everybody can hear.
One side of the court says, we have to interpret the Constitution in the light of changing context. The other side, which happens to be the majority right now, says, no, we have to stick
with the framers.
To the frame,
yeah.
What the framers intended,
yeah.
In the law. And as soon as we depart from that, we destroy our freedom.
That, you know, it is fascinating to look at a distance. As a theologian, it's fascinating to look at how your Supreme Court works with text. Really, really interesting. It is exactly the kind of conversation that's happening in biblical studies. How do we read this Bible? And and as I keep saying, we need to have these conversations. Not build walls and, as happens here, lob our words over the wall at one another in ways that injure one another. We need to find a way of sitting down in rooms and talking about, what are we afraid of? What is the danger of reading it like this or reading it like this? What have we to gain by reading it like this as opposed to reading it like this? And that give and take as we go through.
I think we're very much tied to we're right, you're wrong.
Yeah.
And so how do we come at the story differently in things like the gun violence? I mean, how, you know, control of guns in this country. Because we are clearly right and wrong.
Yeah.
And there isn't...
This is my last comment on it. One of the... related to that last phrase... If we had a little bit more, if we had a few more days with this, we could we could examine this aspect of it, which is liturgically the way the Book of Ruth is used alongside the giving of the law. These two things are read in Jewish tradition side by side. And it raises the prospect that that the Book of Ruth is the lens through which we are to understand the law. And the core of the Book of Ruth is about the transformative value of kindness and compassion. And that the law must always be interpreted through the lens of kindness and compassion. That the function of the law is to increase the measure of kindness and compassion in the world. And where the application of the law results in an unkindness, the law needs to be changed. So reading liturgically in Jewish tradition, reading the law through the lens of Ruth can lead to quite radical action, where we get to talk about the intent and the impact of law. And so the Second Amendment, is that what the gun? I mean, that's a really interesting one. It may be that the conservative reading of that article is the right one. Concede that, and that is the proper intent is to read it this way. However, look at the impact. Look at the impact of that reading. Did anybody see the tweet that went out after the shootings last week, which was a long list of countries and the numbers of mass shootings?
Yes.
There was a flag and a number.
Yep.
And there were 10 or 15 nations mentioned with 0000000, including my own, including the UK, various parts of the world. And then there were two countries or three countries with two mass shootings. There was one country with three mass shootings this year. And then there was the United States with 251. And we look on this and think, in one sense, please don't hear this. I don't intend this disrespectfully. But how in God's name, even if this is the right interpretation of that amendment, read it in the light of 252 mass shootings this year and say, despite the fact what it's designed to protect me from, look at the cost. If the application of law results in increased unkindness, it's bad law. And the Book of Ruth says, change it. It's a good principle. If the application results in unkindness, change it. So that there's more kindness in the world. And if the cost is, maybe I feel a little bit more vulnerable from the interference of the government, I've got to ask myself, can I, with all my resources and all that I have, can I bear that increased sense of fragility or worry in order to save 251 and growing mass shootings in 6 or 7 months? That's the calculation. And I think the Bible gives us permission to say, reinterpret the tradition. You know, way over time. And there's somebody in here at 1:30 who needs to get set up. Again, as I said, I'm not going to be running away from what I'm saying. I'll take responsibility for what I'm saying in public. And I'm very happy to have pushback. I'm going to be hanging around here, and I'm happy to continue the conversation.